This is Monocle on Design, our weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics, and yes, fashion too. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
So we try and convince clients that they need to rethink economics, you know, social economics, and actually rethink their role in contributing to cities and communities.
To kick off our Big Insight series, we speak to the CEO of architecture and consulting practice, Woods Baggett, about priorities, hopes and preoccupations from the top. Plus,
how does sunlight flood into your apartment? How do you gain access to an external amenity? How do you gain access to other people? How do you foster a sense of community?
We speak to an architect creating lively living spaces for the elderly, and not before time. We also find out what Berliners are doing right and how they're bringing that most ineffable and childishly fun element into urban life. That's the act of play, of course. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. Architects were once given a very specific brief to fulfil, along with a very specific budget to hit. But as the pressure they face changes and multiplies, their remit is expanding too. And it includes the spaces in between buildings as well as the buildings themselves. In part one of our Big Insight series, we'll have a few at regular intervals in the coming weeks, we're joined by Nick Corrales, the London-based CEO of Australia-founded architecture and consulting practice Woods Baggett. Nick spoke to the show's producer, Daphne Karnesis, about his priorities and hopes for the year ahead. Corrales started by explaining how he sees the role of firms such as his and how it's all changing.
There's a changing responsibility and role of the contemporary architect to move away from accepting a brief on face value and delivering an aesthetic in response to really an ethical domain. And their role is to challenge the brief per se and see what else they can extract in terms of the value to community and society beyond the little project that they're dealing with. So there's a major role that we all need to play.
Talking about this kind of shifting role and responsibility, do you think it's ever the architect's responsibility also not to build, especially in overcrowded cities now where there's also a lot of work to do in terms of restoring buildings? We're hearing a lot about reusing and things like infill. Are these also priorities for you?
There's the responsibilities across two domains. Yes, around repurposing and regeneration, really important. And a lot of our work actually in China at the moment is using old industrial sites where they would have demolished them and then repurposed them into multifunctional spaces. And we're seeing a lot of emergence of how we can economically readapt buildings. But on the other domain, architects have a responsibility to create new buildings that are more flexible, i.e. not a single purpose, not redundant before they're actually built. And so with the two together, you can imagine that we do create more flexible buildings of greater longevity that can perform more than one task. So we should build, but we should build differently. We should regenerate, but regenerate with flexibility in mind.
That's really interesting. So let's talk about cities, because there is a debate about how we can adapt to the various, you know, future challenges that our cities will face and how master planning can play a role in that. Challenges like overpopulation, the effects of climate change. How has your approach changed to building
cities? We think there's a fundamental shift from suburban back to urban. And urbanity or urbanism or globalism is actually a potential savior for society. As we all know, by 2035, maybe 75% of the world's population will become urban. And there's a real reason for that. Urbanism is to belong to a community rather than to belong to a segregated little quarter acre block. Some of the research work we did in LA, more LA actually studied the amounts of available car parking spaces in cities and how we can readapt them to increase the density of cities in their same configuration. And in fact, we demonstrated we could put 3 million more people in the city of LA at the expense of cars. So there is still a greater move to the notion of the reinstatement of the city as being kind of the change around density and how we communicate with our fellow citizens. Mm. So we're very positive of the role city plays. We're actually, every design element from building to room to space should be centered around the idea of how it contributes to the city.
And obviously, consulting work is part of the bread and butter of what you do. What concerns are clients coming to you with?
That's a very good question, Daphne. There's two major concerns. Is the fear of disruptive technology. They're terrified about when and how should they respond, or should they wait? Is it a trend? Will it go away? Should I bury my head in the sand and constant markets will come back? Second common theme we get from our clients is designing for millennials. What are their aspirations? I don't quite understand them. How can I design something that's fit for purpose for their needs, you know, they're digital and analog. So these two things,
both technology
and kind of the priorities and values of millennials, which are really changing the way we perceive and use space, are amazing, for me, amazing opportunities. For a lot of our clients, they're very concerned about how do they respond, because the market's saying one thing, build this and you will get this much money, yet society's saying, actually, I don't want that. I want smaller, I want more flexible, I want more amenity. So we try and convince clients that they need to rethink economics, you know, social economics, and actually rethink their role in contributing to cities and communities. So it's a very fascinating dilemma right now.
Just briefly, because obviously we can go on about it quite a lot, what are those social economics when it comes to millennials that companies should take into account?
Look, we don't use the word sustainability anymore. We use the word consciousness. Millennials have a new emerging consciousness around a number of ethical, gender, ownership, contribution to community. Their values are so profoundly different that they kind of reconstructing or being part of how we should look at the built environment. Yeah, so it's a really interesting time now, I think, time in architecture for it to ethically respond to this and not continue its old methodologies. And what we're trying to do in redefining a new kind of empathy methodology is mapping out how creativity doesn't come from the genius, it comes from the client, the community, and the creative. So it's kind of like this Venn diagram of this triple input into that, and we'll be publishing that shortly. But still there's a lot of work to do to unravel that conundrum.
And just going back to technology and how you, I guess, can balance things like smart technology with more traditional tools. I'm thinking things like the programming of spaces and tactility. Do you think that we've somewhat embraced the former, so technology, more than not paying enough attention to the latter?
So at Woods Bagot, we've invested a lot of research into technology. We've created a sub-research brand called Superspace. Superspace does human cognition recognition and data simulation. It looks at patterns of the way people use space. So in many ways, it's mapping kind of analog behaviors and representing it in a visual simulation. And we can actually see how people really use space, not how we think they use space. So technology has this profound ability to change architecture. Now, there's a lot of people who fear technology, thinking that it equals AI or machine learning, or it doesn't have a human dimension.
Loss of the human dimension.
But in fact, it can accurately map what is real behavior and how people experience space. It can demonstrate to that. So we are harnessing it. We're using it to create what we call user briefs. We're almost throwing away the traditional RFP or request for proposal, which is an area spatial analysis, and changing that with an experiential analysis. And that brings in the tactility and the emotional dimension of how people respond to space and volume and light and darkness, and how you can use that indeed to shift what we think the practice of architecture should be. So very exciting times if you harness the better qualities of technology.
Yeah, in the right way.
In the right way. Yeah.
And for you, what would you say, you know, you mentioned some of the research that you're currently undertaking, but what are the biggest priorities for you this year in 2019?
Well, we are predicting a change in the practice of architecture. And one of the biggest things that my team are working on emanates out of the notion of global studio, which is the fundamental basis of us. We're not a founder firm practice. We're a firm based on foundations, and those foundations are kind of empathy, people-based architecture, diversity is really important to us. So we're capturing all this and producing a manifesto. I feel there's a time in art history where manifestos are relevant, but right now someone needs to come up with a statement of purpose.
Yeah, we actually did it.
What we should be doing and what is the reason for architecture. So this year is busy with us collecting a lot of thinkers around this and doing some research and proving the manifesto by research and case study. So that's what we're trying to do in 2019 and using some of our work to demonstrate that.
So we'll be waiting for a manifesto from you guys
soon. Yes,
we actually did a show. Our last show was about manifestos, actually. So
Now they're still relevant. And what is the cause and purpose of it? And what do you sense to achieve? And the problem I have with a manifesto, it's a fixed doctrine, not a process, not a changing methodology of how to shift the practice of architecture. So we're trying to even redefine what a manifesto is and its core purpose.
I just want to move now to talk a bit about how the way we work is changing. And here on the show, we've been looking a lot about the changing nature of the workplace and office design and how we're building. How do you think that the way we work is changing and how is it reflected in how we build our offices?
Really important question to us. At Woods Bagot, we have 11 sectors and we have this thing called sector blur. So we actually use our workplace sector in conjunction with our education sector in conjunction with our hotel sector. So we're mixing it up. We're also predicting the demise, as I said, of a single-purpose workplace building. Here is an office tower. Here is a lobby. No one else will come into it. So we're reshaping what we think a mixed-use typology is. And 447 Collins Street is an example of that in Melbourne, where we have a hotel, an office, a park, residence, and hospitality all in one building. We're lucky to have a full city block where we're reimagining multiple uses of that one property asset. So it's a big fundamental shift to single purpose buildings, and that's how cities are fundamentally changing. They're no longer districts of single use, but they're an aggregation of communities.
That was Nick Corrales, the CEO of architecture firm Woods Bagot, speaking to this show's producer, Daphne Karnesis. Do stay tuned. Now, retirement housing tends to be drab, dull, dated, and a dehumanisingly dire affair, I'm sorry to say. A sad prospect for any of us to depart to. But as people begin to live longer and earn more money, many are waking up to the urgent need to provide better quality of life well into old age. So, how do we create elderly homes that one would move into out of desire rather than sheer desperation? Much of the answer lies in canny design, of course. And UK developer Pegasus Life has been recruiting architecture studios to build enviable retirement communities around the country. One of these is the newly opened Bellevue in London's leafy Hampstead. As the first residents move in, Monocle's Melkon Çarçoğlu, a man old before his time, also dropped by to talk to Joe Morris, the architect behind the build.
The Bellevue over-60s residence in Hampstead doesn't look like an elderly community at all. At first glance, it more resembles a hotel. Indeed, it has many of the same amenities. A lively ground floor cafe, a rooftop terrace with arguably the best view of London I've ever seen, and even a state-of-the-art spa, gym and pool. Well, that really is the point here. Traditional elderly housing, whether private or public, is too hospitalised in its approach and appearance. Worse, it fails to cater for what the elderly really need, such as company, a bit of lively bustle, or easy access to the local high street. Partly it comes down to poorly thought out design, but Pegasus Life has been giving skilled architects a tabula rasa to design objectively attractive housing that also meets the subtle needs of the ageing.
So I guess the vision for this project, and I guess also the kind of collective vision that was shared with the client Pegasus Life, whose entire modus operandi is to deliver a holistic vision for people going into retirement, which is obviously incredibly sensitive. The architecture had to respond to multiple layered and complex factors. The building location, the site location is complicated. It was one of a first wave of projects for the client, so therefore sort of pushing boundaries. So there's a certain degree of innovation in thinking and in method that we designed and communicated the project to the local authority. Understanding stakeholder engagement, so the kind of wider community and how they sort of fitted into this. So we were trying to build something, which I think we have done, which draws on all of these factors in a very structured and careful way to create something which we think will stand the test of time. So it's doing simple things. So the layout of flats obviously is driven so that sunlight and daylight and the way that an ageing community can work around them. So it's about aiding mobility, door widths, corridor widths, window opening mechanisms, all the simple things. But at the same time, thinking in a visionary way. So how does sunlight flood into your apartment? How do you gain access to an external amenity? How do you gain access to other people? How do you foster a sense of community? How do you create spaces where you can hide away by yourself and be intimate? How do you create spaces of domesticity and connectivity with others? So it's all of that, really. The idea of it being a holistic vision is very much of itself the individual through to the collective of the residents and actually the wider community as well.
That's Joe Morris, founder of Morris & Co Architects. Many retirement homes, public or private, are on the outskirts of town, which probably feels like being locked away rather than retiring. However, Bellevue boasts an enviable plot, right in the heart of Hampstead, off a thriving high street and a few minutes from Hampstead Heath. Besides, it's next to a primary school, a trivial juxtaposition to us, but one that's sure to gladden the residents as they take their morning coffee.
I think the client's approach to this sector, it was actually really, really interesting, and I think innovative in its type and of its time in a way. So obviously the zeitgeist that they're sitting within is the expanding population and the aging population, which is the kind of big growth sector. That's the first thing. The second thing is obviously London. London is white hot for all sorts of sectors, not least of which is the residential sector, which we're all aware of. And then obviously you have a very affluent demographic of people that have worked all their lives, who have generated financial security and have an abundant ability to be able to, I suppose, afford spaces which are uplifting, have been designed to accommodate their own ambition for the rest of their life. And this building has an expected lifespan for every resident of somewhere between 10 and 20 years. We're talking about the very latter end of their lifespan. So it's about saying Hampstead already has an established, rooted residential community. Hampstead, in terms of its analysis of data or analysis of its people, has an aging population already. And in order to foster a kind of continuous economy within the residential market, you've got to build somewhere where people can move in order for the bottom end of the market, which is the single person buyers, to be able to move into something. So you're creating momentum, I suppose. So we knew that the people that were living here had all of those, and it was a case of making sure that we designed and delivered exceptional accommodation to enable them to see the benefits and then move and begin the chain reaction.
The location reflects the design philosophy here. Luxury furniture and elegant lighting are all well, but ultimately a sense of community is key to Morris & Co's architectural vision. That means a large communal courtyard to encourage company and friendship. The ground floor cafe is open to the public so that residents might engage with their community and vice versa. Or, more subtly still, individual apartment entrances have little Dutch doors that, when half opened, tacitly invite passers-by to pop in.
So the form of the building was designed through huge amount of iteration. So the client sort of set a benchmark, which we've achieved, which is somewhere between sort of 50 plus and 60-ish units, that being the sort of quantum which sort of corresponded to or responded to the initial outlay to purchase the site. So the brief is a quantum-based one. And what we were working towards is how do you create uplifting space matching the quantum brief of the client within a hugely constrained site. And so we went through a kind of typological process of evaluating approaches and strategies to arrive at the scheme that we see today, which effectively is four interconnected blocks with a simple rectilinear form. So you're driving efficiencies, and you're not overcomplicating the kind of build. There's an idea of repetition, so you get efficiencies through repeated details. But through that repetition and through the kind of efficiencies, you get to explore materiality, you get to explore detail, colour, texture, relief, and variation. And it's understanding that the sort of, I suppose, the creative tension between something which is highly repetitive and has the opportunity to kind of evolve into texture and innovation, I suppose. So you end up with a very simple sequence of brick buildings interconnected by a kind of a sort of snaking corridor through which you continuously gain access to views to the city, so you know where you live, with each of the blocks arranged so that three front doors into three apartments have a close association with one another. And we think that fosters sort of this idea of micro communities. So you have a micro community of three units around one central area of this kind of wide corridor. That then expands to a floor level, which can be anywhere from 3 units to 12 units. And then in terms of the external courtyards and the communal spaces, then up to 60 apartments can come together to create that sort of sense of unified community.
Bellevue is unlike any other Pegasus Life residence. The developer gives the architects almost total freedom and, rather than taking a cookie-cutter approach, encourages them to design a building that echoes its individual surroundings.
So the site, the building, is located within an island which is surrounded by 6 conservation areas, which are residential in character, Victorian and Georgian, ornate, lots of brickwork, lots of kind of window proportions and sort of roof details, which sort of give a sense of where we would want to take the building. And the response is obviously contemporary. We have the hospital nearby, which is a significant building. And I guess what we were trying to do was to draw upon the conservation areas to build a certain mass and certain density on the site to potentially shield the view of the hospital, which by, I think, the local authority's admission, isn't a sort of standout piece of architecture, not to denigrate its valuable work, but in terms of its place setting, was built of in a certain way and of a certain time with certain materials. So this project is rich in terms of its materiality, using readily available materials which correspond to all of those sort of Georgian and Victorian terraces. So a nice brick which has been tumbled and antiquated by hand, textured brick where we've literally taken a standard brick and just rotated it by 15 degrees, working very, very closely with craftsmen and bricklayers to understand how best to facilitate this detail. We've got large expanses of precast architectural stone with a sort of slightly pigmented pink with a pink aggregate in there. And then as the buildings ascend through their height at the very high levels, we have these deep recessed chamfers with a change in mortar, a lighter mortar. And the idea being that, you know, in consultation with the planning authorities, to sort of set a high benchmark in terms of the detail at the higher levels to sort of give a sense of integrity why we might be able to get to those points. And it's the highest points with the views across London, which probably have the most sort of stunning apportioned apartments, right to the very top, where on the very top level there's one apartment with sort of triple aspect looking north towards the Heath and south towards London, which is stunning.
As Morris sits down on a plush sofa in the communal living room, a great big book called Jazz Life on a marble table next to him, we're reminded that Bellevue is a private residence. The apartments will be unaffordable for most over 60s in the UK. But that shouldn't diminish the excellence of the architecture here, nor Pegasus Life's desire to create better retirement houses. In fact, this project asks vital questions by raising the bar. Can some of the lessons learned here be applied in the public sector?
It's true to say that this is pitching at a highly affluent market, and I don't think it makes any bones about that in terms of its, I guess, its materiality, the bespoke nature of some of the details, and so forth. But there are obviously some basic good sense strategies in here which could be rolled out on any number of projects. So orientation, the spatial layout of apartments, access to external amenity, the relationship of buildings to garden spaces, ideas of communal spaces to draw people together, and perhaps more so the relationship of the building to the surrounding existing community and making sure that there is an interface so that people aren't living in silos, people are very much rooted to this existing community, which I think is probably the most important fundamental aspect of the project.
For Monocle in London, I'm Melkon Çarçoğlu.
Finally today, some of the most livable cities are those that provide spaces to play. It's not all serious business, you know. But plonking a one-size-fits-all playground anywhere isn't a recipe for success either. In the latest issue of Monocle magazine, our bumper July-August quality of life instalment, if you're wondering, Hester Underhill explored Berlin's colourful adventure areas. Here's her piece narrated for us by the very kind Daphne Karnesis.
In Marzahn, a district in East Berlin characterised by high-rise concrete housing blocks, lies a colossal beached blue whale. Children crawl into the mouth of this massive mammal, brushing past enormous tonsils through to its stomach or clambering across ropes to its large red heart before climbing up its tail and sliding down a pole onto the sand below. This whale, it's worth noting, is made from wood and flanked by parents who look on from deck chairs outside a curryverse kiosk. This playground in the Garten der Welt Park is one of 1,850 in Berlin, a city proud of its outdoor play offerings. Anna Winger, a mother of two and the producer behind Deutschland 83 and 86, says that she and her family have never had to walk more than a couple of blocks for their kids to run around and play with other kids. She says that there's something about the sanctity of space for kids in the middle of the city that's relaxing, both for parents and their children. When Winger moved to Berlin in the early 2000s, the city's playgrounds stood in contrast to those of her native New York, where the price of real estate limited available space. In New York, she says, nobody would waste a space where you could build 14 stories of residential property. The few playgrounds that are built are crowded and all look exactly the same. The past few years have seen rapid gentrification in Berlin, but years of economic depression meant that the bombed-out plots of land smattered around the city after the Second World War weren't seen as being worth the cost of property development. In these spaces now stand some of the city's most beloved playgrounds, including the Drachenspielplatz, Dragon Playground, in the district of Friedrichshain, in a narrow gap between tall residential blocks on the cobbled Schreinerstraße. A green dragon made from wooden planks bears menacing red fangs. Children climb along its spine before whizzing down the metal slides at its head. It's the design of Berlin's Merry-Go-Round, Germany's largest manufacturer of custom-built wooden playground equipment, which makes its structures by hand in a carpentry workshop in the southern suburb of Teltow. Jens Zumblick, who has managed the company's marketing for the past 25 years, says that wood is warm while metal is cold. That tactile aspect is important. He goes on, most of the wood we use comes from the Black Forest, but the playgrounds we build are mostly in towns. Giving something natural back to these settings is important when it comes to play. The company's designs have won it commissions not only in its hometown, where it also designed play equipment for Berlin Zoo's panda enclosure, but across Northern Europe. In a playground across town in Schönenberg, Hamburg native Mariana Hilmer is watching her three-year-old daughter tackle a rope bridge. She says they didn't have parks like this where she grew up. Mariana and husband Johannes spent the last two summers visiting Berlin's playgrounds and compiling a list of their 34 favourites, which they published as a guidebook, Spielplatzguide Berlin, earlier this year. She says that for people like them who don't have a garden, playgrounds are essential. Children can socialise and it's nice to chat to other parents too, she adds. The city's playgrounds are so important to Berliners that many of the parks have been subsidised by fundraising efforts in the community. In 2016, when another whale-themed climbing frame fell into disrepair in Pankow, schoolchildren and residents raised €14,000 towards its replacement. Folard Kuhn, city councillor for urban development in Pankow, says that playgrounds are a selling point for a district. They give character. But, he adds, in recent years the price of land has gone up and owners want to use it for the highest possible worth. Yet as the arrival of big business continues to transform the city from grungy creative hub to sanitised metropolis, Kuhn is convinced that Berliners will keep fighting to protect their playgrounds. He adds that Berlin has something that you don't get elsewhere in the country and people feel passionate about that.
That was Monocle's Daphne Karnesis pretending to be Monocle's Hester Underhill in a report that she voiced from the design pages of the latest issue of Monocle magazine. You can, of course, find that on all self-respecting newsstands now. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. But don't forget, if you do need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra. Where do we come up with these names? It's available each Thursday, and you can also pick up any of Monocle's books, newspapers or magazines if you head to monocle.com/shop. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Kieran Banerjee. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.